Howdy folks, welcome back to the Newsprint Commando. This is episode, 47 of the season, something like that. My name is Ed Moore, I'm your host. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet me, Facebook me, or Blue Sky me, I don't know what the word for that is, at Teal Productions. Teal is in the color, T-E-A-L. Or on Twitter, you can hit up NewsP Commando. I am IndieMan, I-N-D-I-E. At gmail.com is the email address if you want to email me. The website where the episodes are posted is comicbooknoise.com/T, Tango, N, November, C, Charlie. Just type the letters, not the alpha. All right. This is the first month of multi-books in my Pacific Comics coverage. This is July 1982. Cover date, publishing date. Whichever it is before. I get them confused anymore. Going to be looking at Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers number 6, Ms. Mystic number 1, and Pacific Presents number 1. And what I'll do is cover the books, and if any one file gets to be longer than an hour, I'll break it at an hour and then upload whatever additional to try to break it up into some segments. I think I should be able to keep my thoughts for these three books to write at about an hour, probably 20-ish minutes apiece, but we'll just have to see. So first up, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers. This is brought to us, scripted and penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by Mike Thibodeau, colored by Steve Olaf, and letters by Pelle Jensen. On the cover, we have our typical accoutrement in the upper left, Captain Victory issue 6, Pacific Comics logo for the new era in comics. I can't disagree with that. $1 US, $1.25 Canadian. On the upper left is a huge explosive flag that says Jumbo 48-page issue. And I'll get into why. It's 48 pages as I talk about the book. Banner in defense of our galaxy, ribbon banner, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers below that. Down at the bottom is another flag kind of banner shaped like a sign that says whether fighting for planets or peanuts, victory is sacrifice. And the background picture over which all of this is plastered is an energetically charged face of Captain Victory with explosive release of energy, part of the story actually, behind it. His eyes are reddened as if backlit. His mouth is reddened as if backlit. Ocean at the bottom with some land masses, but it's like it's a big face up in the sky that is exploding, is the image, the takeaway for the image. Inside front cover, we're told that readers said more, and so Pacific Presents The Rocketeer by Dave Stevens on sale in June, and Steve Ditko, The Missing Man, two big features, 32 pages. That is the third book that I'm talking about this episode, so we'll get to that. Narrator tells us when the time is desperate, the enemy still powerful and resolute, and the fighting is at its bloodiest. A galactic commander must decide to win and die. Captain Victory and his Galactic Rangers, victory is sacrifice. Battlefield scene. We've got Captain Victory trying to contact Orca on the... No, Orca is beneath Philadelphia. Born and bred on a playground. No, that's somebody else. But Orca is in Philadelphia. We see that Captain Victory is getting a situational report for him. And as he is attacked by an Insecton who ultimately takes his right eye, damages it to where it is non-functional. Some of his soldiers get there just in time, or not just in time, but get there and destroy the Insectons, but not before the whole right side of his face is scarred up and he has lost the usage of his eye. Orca reports that he is in the Hive, and the Hive has extended to Philadelphia. They are in, is it Spartanville? Somewhere, let me see if I can quickly turn to where it told me. Spartanville, yes, they are in Spartanville. I assume that's Pennsylvania. And the Hive extends from there, if it truly exists, to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is where Orca is beneath the streets, because the hive has extended that far, and now the insectons have erupted, much like you would see the time-sped video of like an anthill growing, and then exploding as the ants come out of it. That's kind of what I envision the insectons are doing. So Captain Victory is seeing that there is another front in Philadelphia now with the insectons. The front that he is on in Spartanville is overrun with insectons, but his men and the U.S. military are roughly holding their own. And to show that even more, we go down into the hive, into the tunnels, where we see several Kirby panels of insectons crawling and running through the tunnel. But suddenly they start being destroyed and picked off, and they explode and die and what have you. To the micro troops that were released a couple issues ago and have now made their way to the insecton front and are deployed and destroying them in the hive, while the forces are destroying them outside the hive in Spartanville. Meanwhile, insectons have now appeared in Philadelphia. So we have essentially now three fronts, all connected by these tunnels where they tunnel underground in the hive. Orca starts trying to pick off some insectons from where he is, but he doesn't do that too much because it'll give away his position, and they will come at him, and he'll be sorely outnumbered. Captain Victory gives a command to his ship, the Tiger, I believe. I didn't write that down, but I believe it's called the Tiger, as it is floating up in the sky here, to release the package. We've done our best. It's heading down, is what we're told. And we see a big Kirby box detach from the ship. And then, you know, some sort of magnetic or gravitic waves are controlling the box as unto dispatching it and lowering it down to the surface of the Earth. Terran is giving Captain Victory what for down here on the battlefield. Terran heard the order by the captain, and he understands that the usage of this weapon denotes something bad for whoever is running it, automating it, however it's going to be controlled. And Terran doesn't feel that it should be Captain Victory that does this, that he, Terran, should be the one to do it, because Captain Victory is the big man, and the big man should not take this. Kind of like constant episodes of Star Trek where the captain will beam down with the away team, and you always wonder, well, being the captain, shouldn't he stay on the ship? Because he's the HMFIC, and send somebody else in case, you know, nobody makes it? Well, this is Captain Victory. They're beaming down, essentially, an away team in this mechanical whatever last resort it's going to be. But he, Captain Victory, is taking charge of it. Terran disagrees. Captain Victory poo-poos and says, well, you know, I'm the one in charge and it's my call anyways. So we see that Terran turns and starts fighting insectons. You know, that's what he has left to do since he can't go on this other mission. We cut to the insectons in Philadelphia. We see that they're starting to spread out. Cut back to the actual front of the fighting at Spartanville. The military and the Galactic Rangers are being overrun. We then have two pages that have 10 Kirby panels in them. Two panels have narration. Two panels have word balloons. And that's it. The rest is eyeball candy of colored Kirby art. Awesome stuff. We're told, starting off on the left-hand side, first panel, on the edge of Spartanville, Captain Victory looks towards the night sky. He looks up and he sees this big box of whatever it is descending down. Third panel, the thing that lands is larger than the buildings surrounding it. Captain Victory says, open the door. Panel, he walks inside. Next panel, take me up. And we see a beam stab down and grab him, and he's rising in the beam. And then the next five panels are him as he's donning a suit of some, maybe a protective suit, although we see later in the story it really doesn't do a very good job of that. And he sits down in this seat, grasps a couple control handles that are before him, and he looks in this scope that is attached to the handles that are has dropped down from the ceiling in front of him. Page turn. full-page Kirby panel. This thing from the outside, it's a humanoid suit kind of in a chair with this big ray dual gun apparatus up from behind him over his head and extending out past his body. But in activating all this, the force is such that everything within the immediate area is just crumbled and destroyed. And so we have artifacts of what were blasting away from this. And it's not, we don't see a side shot and we don't see it from the front. It's kind of a three quarters or half 45 degree turn between a full side and the front view. So that's the angle that Kirby drew this at. Massive energy. Yeah, cool stuff. Narrator tells us next page, next panel, as its great fibrous cover is blown away, the huge drainer, that's what Captain Victory called it, released the drainer when he called it down, activated by Captain Victory, begins to seek out and consume all sources of energy in its path. Next panel. Electric cables hidden beneath the abandoned streets of Spartanville burst into view and writhe like serpents shedding their inner powers. Next panel, half page. The drainer levitates and moves into the empty town. Spartanville, shorn by the insectons of its inhabitants, now shudders and dances in torment. Energy ripoff becomes a rising sinister storm. So basically this drainer is sucking any and all available energy, whether it be biologic, whether it be man-made, whether it be mechanical, nuclear, solar, it's draining all possible energy. Anything that contained the energy that isn't ambient is reduced to rubble, because even the energy to hold that matter in place is being sucked away by the drainer. So basically, everything is being reduced to rubble and ash. We have a couple panels where an insecton here hears what's going on and pokes its head up. Tendrils of energy go and grab it and suck it dry too, and then it falls back into the hole. Seals the hole up. The tendrils are seeking other avenues of energy, and on over here somewhere they find an open tunnel, and so the tendrils descend into the tunnel, into the insecton hive, and now they're spreading throughout the hive, sucking the energy from all the insectons it encounters as it's traveling out and away from Spartanville toward Philadelphia also. So this not only is destroying the front in Spartanville in favor of the Galactic Rangers, but it's also destroying all insectons in the hive, moving towards in tendrils and waves, the energy suction towards Philadelphia. Ultimately, Terran and a troop of Galactic Rangers and U.S. soldiers approach. The general in charge says, "I've never seen anything like this. There's not even the faintest sounds or, and one of his soldiers finishes, "or the smell of death." That's it. The bodies don't smell, because all matter, all the energy binding the matter even, has been taken away. So there is nothing to rot and smell. So, yeah. Panel, page here. We have a half-page panel of the drainer amidst of a huge hurricane cloud formation looking vortex of energy, as the two cannony devices that rise above and stick out from this apparatus called the drainer are sucking tendrils of energy in, and then the energy has coalesced around it. It can only siphon in so much. So the residual energy in the process of being siphoned is this huge maelstrom of energy around the drainer. Inside the drainer, Captain Victory is being torturously flooded with this life energy. It says, the narrator tells us, life that penetrates and floods every corner of the pilot's body. Unlike death, the electric qualities of life are restless, shifting, tumultuous, seeking growth, power, solidity, and change. And that panel is of this melting, morphing. Maybe it was supposed to originally have been the face of Captain Victory. aboard the ship, Major Clavis and the lizard doctor, whose name I forget at this point, are arguing back and forth because the doctor, inventor, creator of the drainer, by order of Captain Victory, knows what's going on. Clavis, is just now finding out what's going on, and he objects also. Captain Victory being a friend of his, but also the leader. You know, our leader should not be doing this to himself. Well, the scientist is like, well, you know, I just did what I was told, so that's the way it is. He's alive. He's reacting to monumental searches of anti-death. I haven't killed him, fool. This is the doctor. I've given him one gigantic dose of life, he tells Taryn, like he's proud of that or something. Whereas I don't know that Captain Victory would be too proud right now. I mean, he knew by word, you know, what he was getting himself into, but never having done this before, he didn't actually know by experience. Panel of them arguing. We've got Taryn checking with the surface people that he has, Orca on one side, this is Clavis on the ship. He's checking with Taryn at the Spartanville front. He's checking with Orca beneath Philadelphia to see what's going on. Then they're watching as down below we see that a couple things have happened. A huge insecton ship has risen from the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay. This is probably the mothership of everything, and it's rising to get away because it sees this energy and it has determined what the drainer is doing, and this huge ship does not want to be a part of it for a variety of reasons. So it's attempting to get away. In the maelstrom of energy, all the apparatus that was behind, perhaps supporting the drainer, is breaking away to where now it's just this huge kaiju-looking giant robot with no accoutrement except the two big siphons that are siphoning the energy. Suddenly, it leaps and takes off almost as if it's alive. It has sensed this big ship trying to get away, and it's going to suck that ship dry of energy too. So it chases it out to the somewhere between our moon and Mars is how far the ship got trying to escape before the drainer found it. And the drainer is about a quarter the size of the ship, but it grabs a portion of the ship, kind of like some kind of parasite, right, or something like that, and just starts draining and draining and draining the ship until everything, the drainer, the ship, everything explodes into basically just the remaining matter, all of the energy having been drained away. And we don't know what happens to it because everything disappears. And our final three panels are here of Clavis on the Dreadnought Tiger. Okay, so I was right. The Captain Victory ship is called a Tiger. One of the crew members says, they're gone. War is horrible. Horrible. Clavis says, the Victory is sacrifice. Other soldier. Yes, sir. The dead Earth folk. The loss of Captain Victory. Clavis. Wrong. They live on. Victory is sacrifice. But sacrifices continuity. Contact medical. Tell them to proceed with a new Captain Victory clone. And we have seen that in previous issues, that there's just row upon row of Captain Victory clone. Maybe as a normal process of the Galactic Rangers, but I suspect also because Captain Victory is prone to throw himself headlong into situations and doesn't survive all the time. We then have a two-page spread that tells us, coming fast, coming mean, you won't believe the Galactic Files on the Wonder Warriors. Watch for them in the next issue of Captain Victory. And there are four roughly humanoid creatures. One appears potentially to be female, and that is just alluding to because of the long reddish hair. All of them are covered in armor. One face makes exposed face makes this one dude look kind of alienish. Continuing narration. Also on its way, the new mind-blowing Kirby concept for which you've been waiting, inquiring, demanding. So what can we do? We'll deliver. Watch for it. And this is signed Kirby 1981. Yeah, massive, massive Kirby. Letters page, a Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers subscription page here to send in. a really cool ad at the very top. It says a nonprofit corporation for the advancement of the arts. It's an ad, a full-page ad for the San Diego 1982 Comic-Con, July 8 through 11, 1982. And it lists several things that are going on. Film festival, meet the stars, in-person San Diego Convention of the Performing Arts. It's got a list of attendees here. Many great, great names. What caught my eye was down here a little ad for the Hotel San Diego. For a single room, it was $37.10 in 1982 to go to the San Diego Comic-Con for one night, okay, a single, $37.10. A double or twin was $42.40, and a triple was $47.70. So if you got a triple bed and you split that three ways, that would be what, $16? That'd be $16 a piece? Come on, man. $16 a piece per night for 8, 9, 10, 11, four nights at the San Diego Comic-Con in 1982 to meet this list of creators here? Man. Okay. Next up, we have a special featurette, also by Jack Kirby. Narrator tells us, every living, thinking, acting thing has its right to a fair shake in this universe, even if it's a cluster of free-floating atoms which gives you frights, blights, and awesome sights. In short, Goozlebobber. This is one. Several issues back, several of the creatures, other aliens that were refugees. There's the word I'm looking for. Refugees that the Galactic Rangers had encountered that were on their ship. Several of them, including the Goozlebobber, decided to get away. Well, Goozly Boo here got into someone's house and was pretending to be some of the stuffed animals. The kids started playing with it, and then the parents heard that the kids were playing around with something. They didn't know what was going on, went to check. So now the parents and the kids are in the room here with the Goozlebobber, along with a couple police officers who responded because I believe before they realized that Goozlebobber really wasn't hurting anything. One of the parents, if I recall, called to report something going on. So the cops are here, and the Goozlebobber takes on the visage of a large dinosaurish reptilish thing, and then a goofy, balloony, buck-toothed-y, funny-faced kind of dude, and then some kind of greenish alien with a long neck and like a head three times the size of the rest of its body. As it's talking to the officers, scaring the poo out of the officers, until finally the dad steps forward and says, yeah, this is just a quick change. Does he call it an alien? Somehow he talks it up. Actually, officer, it was the alien who felt threatened. So he tells it, which is funny, he tells him it's an alien and that actually he is not scaring. He is not a threat. And the officers take their word for it and they leave. But it's an alien, so yeah. Anyway, so it's Kirby's world. You know, I'm just a passenger. So they leave, and then Goozlebobber thanks the husband and wife and is showing them more of what he can do, changing into some things that are turn out to be very, very frightening, such that the dad grabs up the one son and says, okay, we've seen enough of your inventory. And the mother grabs up the daughter and says, you'll frighten the children if you go on. Please, feel free to leave at once if you like, which is kind of passive-aggressive kind of thing. You know, please leave now if you want to. Go if it's okay. You know, yeah, so Goozlebobber does. He takes off, runs away. At the end of this little short, he encounters these two policemen in the visage of one Ronnie, Bonzo? Reagan, who tells him, needn't make a fuss. Just flag down a 747 at the airport for me and put it on hold. Narrator tells us, that night a jumbo jet takes to the night sky, its destination unknown. Is there a Goozlebobber somewhere in mid-flight above your area? You won't know until his crew contracts the dread galactic condition known as cosmic diarrhea. Weird. Coming soon, Grew the Wanderer, big two-page ad. And looking at a handy-dandy chart here, it looks like Gru is scheduled to be a topic the second episode of the next season. So that's a few months away as far as your listening time. Starting in Pacific Comics, which is the book that I'm looking at here in a little bit. It's too late to run and hide. He's changing. Soon you'll find yourself facing the missing man. And then a full-page Star Slayer ad here. Finally, we get The Kill Brothers, or The Missing Man, The Kill Brothers by Steve Ditko. This is scripted, penciled, and inked by Steve Ditko with a dialogue assist from Mr. Mike Vanier. Colors by Steve Olaf and letters by Shelley Lefferman. Mark, not Mike, Mark Vanier. And we're introduced to Kill Brothers, who's a dude that has four faces on his head. Okay, we only ever see three faces, but we're told this is the face of evil, one of four, in fact. Collectively, they are the Kill, K-H-I-L-L, brothers, lords of the Order of Kill. I could only find three of them named, Rapu, R-A-P-U, Masi, M-A-S-I, and Igo, I-G-O. The fourth face, which ideally would be on the back, facing the back of the skull, the skull is never turned, so we see that face. But he's dressed kind of 80s interpretation of India, maybe kind of like a yogi or someone that would practice some of the more meditative religions, I use that word loosely, of India, as they would be portrayed in the 80s at this time. And he's got a big wavy looking sword, sacrificial dagger almost size, not really. In one panel it looks like a sword, in another panel it looks like a dagger. In the way that he's wielding it, I would suggest it's probably more dagger sized. But he's coming down some steps, the Kill Brothers here, or I guess they are. And he throws the knife at a woman we will find out is named Verna Voss. But the missing man is there, and he pushes Verna out of the way, and the dagger clanks to the floor. Now, the missing man puts me in mind of another later Ditko creation. Mr. A, maybe, is what he's called. Yeah, I apologize. That just came to mind. I should have done some research. But this missing man is a head with hair and mouth and glasses and ear. No nose, but no body, and just stick drawings for arms and legs. And he's got hands and feet. So there is nothing of any kind from that would qualify as a trunk. All you see walking around is a head, two arms, and two legs. So he then jumps the Kill Brothers and is fighting them. And in the midst of fighting them, Vera, who we find out has been held captive by the Kill Brothers and actually had broken loose and was trying to escape, turns on them with looks like an automatic weapon of some sort, and is firing at both of them. So the missing man dives to the side. The Kill Brothers dive out a window. When the gun runs dry of ammo, missing man comes out from hiding and then chases after the Kill Brothers, who are nowhere to be seen. So outside, after looking around a little bit, missing man just poofs, changes back in a pop of energy to Syd Mane, S-Y-D-M-A-N-E. I think that's a really cool name. Syd Mane. So the next day, we are introduced to Ma's detective agency, and we're introduced to Ma. She's in charge, older woman. We're introduced to Toady, who is a girl dressed in a jazzy, jammy kind of mini skirt dress-ish thing. Another dude with a flower-lapelled white tux, brightly colored tie and pants that kind of correspond. So they are a detective agency, but they have contacts out in the street that they call in, and they give information to try to find the Kill Brothers, who are out running around somewhere on the lam, hoping that one of their street informants will give them the 411 as to where they are. Syd is later that day at Mammoth Enterprises, Inc. I can't believe it. It's fixed. 8 weeks, our technicians tried to repair this computer, and Syd Vane, it's not Vane though, it's Maine, walks in and it's fixed in 20 minutes. And then Sid looks down at a pen sticking out of his lapel pocket. There's Ma's signal. Soon as I slip away, I'll find out what info she has for missing man. Then we cut to the Kill brothers, who have found Verna once again, have her tied up, and they're going to kill her again with this. They're going to sacrifice her for some reason. But, well, once again, missing man shows up. Fighty, fighty, fighty. Throws Kill brothers through a window at this place. Now, this place kind of looks a little bit more like Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorum inside. There's some candles. But the thing that really gets me is that the missing man throws the Kill brothers through a circular window in an upper floor of this building. It's right on the edge of the waterfront. The Kill brothers plummet into the harbor there and disappear. We find out that when throwing him, that the missing man had grasped the head of this figure and ripped off a mask, because he's holding a mask that has three faces on it, like a rubber mask. And then we're told, coming soon, Queen Bee is her name, and it means trouble for the missing man, by Steve Ditko, Bee, B-E-E, here. Another full-page ad for Gru the Wanderer. The biggest news of 1982, Ms. Mystic, full-page ad here. Ms. Mystic being the book we're going to talk about next. Watch for these exciting comics coming from Pacific Comics. Full-page ad for Star Slayer, Ms. Mystic, The Missing Man, which is a part of Pacific Presents, Gru the Wanderer, and The Rocketeer, which is the other part of Pacific Presents. Letters page, a Pacific Comics reader survey number 2, which is terrible on the inside back cover, because in order to return it as they ask, you would have to cut this out and return. That's a terrible idea. Terrible. And then on the back page, we have a 2/3 Kirby drawing here, full color, but the narrator tells us, or someone, actually, I think Jack Kirby tells us, once again, a memory storage unit will activate a clone and Captain Victory will live once more. The special man goes on to be seen again and again, for he is the best part of ourselves, and that must live until it becomes all of what we are and verifies that we are all special. So be sharp and listen and look for the door where the cosmos is waiting to show you much more. Jack Kirby. Yeah, okay. So that's why it was 48 pages, because there was a lot stuffed into that for only a dollar. Now, 1981, a dollar was pretty pricey, but looking here, Ms. Mystic was a dollar and Pacific Presents was a dollar also. So I believe maybe Pacific was kind of pushing additional content at a dollar. All right, so next up, Ms. Mystic, issue number 1. Front page here we have is a picture of she holding her sword. All the Pacific stuff is in the upper left-hand corner, upper right-hand corner per se. Ms. Mystic, just nice blocky created letters here. We see Ms. Mystic floating above the earth, holding her big sword forward towards us. Origin issue, it tells us, Ms. Mystic is saying, from this day onward, the planet Earth is under my protection. Defile it not, or suffer the wrath of Ms. Mystic. Now, she herself, normally built female, long, long flowing white hair. She's got this, it's not really a headdress, but it's this jewelry-like thing that goes around the back of her neck, and then it comes up in big circles around her ears, like the Leia hair does. But then as the one piece of metal, if you envision it, coming across the back of her neck and then spiraling several times on the sides of her head. And then when the spiral reaches the upper part of the twist, it comes out above her head and bends outward into two like antenna-looking things. She's got a black bodysuit on that ends beneath her arms. There's a brooch that seems to connect it to a neck band that then descends into the sleeves of her arms. Can't see the back to see exactly how it's connected, if the upper arm neck piece is connected to the bodysuit. In the front, it's just connected via this brooch at about throat level. So there's open to the skin around the shoulders, across the front of the chest, tapering down towards beneath the arms, if I even remotely describe that well. Inside front, is an editorial piece by David Scroggie. First story part, Ms. Mystic, at a distance so great that to describe it would be futile, floats an entity whose serenity masks a frantic intelligence, an intelligence bent on a constant, unending search for a very small thing. The background of that panel looks like just a scene of space. We see stars so far away that they're dots. We see closer planets, some stars that are closer, and you can tell by like a starburst feature around them. In the middle is who we will find out is Ms. Mystic, but it's as if she is in the midst of doing a back dive, right? And we see just as her upper torso is about to bend into the dive with her arms extended and her long hair draping down through about two-thirds of her body as she is bending like that. Our story opens in the Arizona desert. A unique vehicle eats up miles of road as it plows deeper into the wastelands. Inside, an equally unique group of people talk animatedly about their destination. And these people are Dennis Swan, Baron Cotter, Dr. Ross, Jake, Jacob Rabinowitz, Dwight God, and Dr. Kelly Tech Kane. So we have three Caucasian males, an older Caucasian doctor, a man of color, and a female. And they're in, it almost looks like the Ark 2 from that old 1980s live-action Saturday morning show. I believe this series may have even been called the Ark 2, something like that. But that's what it looks like, and they're driving around, and Dr. Ross is answering them and telling a story about a typical situation for us. Pollution is our business, isn't it? And he's telling them that they're going to a place where the pollution is so bad. And in the panels that have been drawn by, which I have failed to tell you, this is scripted, penciled, and inked by Neil Adams, colors by Corey Adams, and lettered by John Costanza. So this is actually Neil Adams, Ms. Mystic, but it didn't say that on the cover yet. I think when he takes it over to Continuity Comics, the property, I think that's how it's labeled. But we have a couple issues here that we'll be able to talk about with Pacific Comics. Okay, where he's telling how polluted things are, we have nine panels. The top three show a bird that suddenly falls out of the sky. The second three panels shows a deer that's running about and then decides to vomit and then stumbles and falls. And the bottom three panels, we see an elder person, don't know if it's male or female, being loaded into an ambulance. And amongst the people watching the ambulance go away is a young boy who then in the final panel coughs into his hand. Okay, our pollution hunters here, which they get a name on pollution specialist, or here, the science investigation, science investigation agency. So SIA. And I am moderately distracted because I'm looking for a pen, and there we go. Alrighty, back to the story. They get to a bluff overlooking this very, very large factory spewing just uncontrolled amounts of gunk into the air. The doctor, let's see, what was his name? Dr. Ross, not to be confused with Dr. Kelly Kane. He picks up a megaphone and he is talking to the factory in the distance. You people inside the factory, we've been commissioned by the federal government to inspect your factory. Yada, yada, yada. He holds up a dead rabbit as evidence of what is going on. And this large gun of some sort pokes up out of one of the chimneys that has ceased spewing gunk, aims at them, and swats at them with a scash sound, shooting. I don't know. At first, it looks like energy, but then it looks like projectiles, so I'm not exactly sure. But they run back to their arc-like vehicle and extend a huge one-inch steel panel that everybody hides behind, except for one of them, and this would be Dennis Swan, who has some kind of gun that he says has only three charges in it. And from a rather great distance, he takes aim at this weapon firing at them and destroys it. So then they're talking about what next. They're putting the shield back in place as it's a part of the ARC vehicle that they have here. And they pull out this levitating platform rocket-powered ridey thing that then Baron Cotter, and it's Baron, like that's his name, not like a position or a title. Baron Cotter, wonder if he's related to Gabe. Was that his name? Gabe Kaplan is the dude's name, or I think. But what was his name? Something Cotter from Welcome Back, Cotter. Anyway, sorry. My mind wanders. He is riding this platform and rides towards the factory to, I'm not really sure what he's trying to do. I think maybe he's just surveying things to see what it looks like between where everyone else is and the factory to see if there's any impediments to them going ahead and taking the ARC up to the factory. And as he's riding to the factory, one whole wall of the factory drops down and these things roll out. They're on big wheels and it looks like just a giant mechanical head with two arms attached to it. And there's three of them that are spit out and attack the Baron, or attack Baron, like I said, it's not a title, and are running running him away. And as he's running, they're chasing him. So they pull their big steel panel back out, and they're hiding behind it. Baron has a grenade of some sort in his hand that he primes, and he throws at one robot, and it destroys it. And by this time, Dr. Ross has decided that Baron has given them enough time to pull out, got to aim at the nerve center of that thing. All we can do is concentrate our energy, some kind of psychic. Here it is. According to my detectors, those machines are being controlled by psychic as well as mechanical means. In order to fight them, we must form a psychic link. So they have this big device that they've pulled out. Everybody has headphone-looking things on, and they're focusing their psychic energy, take out one of the robots, leaving one. But in the process, this psychic wave that they have created, this energy, reaches out and makes contact with this woman that we saw in the very first page of the story. She reaches out and she says, it's holding, pulling me through. I can hardly believe it. I'm free, free at last. And she comes blasting out of this bubble of darkness flying onto the earth, dressed much as I described off the front cover here. And she intercepts this final big-wheeled robot and slices it up with her sword. Now, her sword is pretty cool looking because it's a circle. Sorry. Another distraction there. Her sword. The pommel is a circle of energy with 8 spikes spread out around it. Okay. And then from the bottom of the circle, extending through the circle and up away from the top, is the sword hilt itself. With her holding the sword in the circle with that straight piece that's going from bottom to top. And that's her sword, all made of energy. And she's wielding it against the robot, destroys the robot, but then in it being destroyed, it kind of knocks her for a loop, and all of our ARC members run out here away from the safety of their vehicle now. They run out to much closer to the factory now and interact with Ms. Mystic. There's some goings back and forth here, and the dude that's in charge, Dr. Ross, he seems very, I don't know. He takes her story at face value a little too quickly, I think. She just appeared out of nowhere. And at that, she came out of this big black bubble, like a big, you know, soap bubble, and just burst through it. So you're in the middle of the desert. You're fighting these robots. And then all of a sudden, this big black sphere appears, and out of the black sphere merges, you know, just the sphere just emits this person all dressed in black with long blonde hair. And yeah, I'm like, anyways. So they're talking back and forth, and he asks her to help. Oh, yeah, you want to help? Hey, can you blow a hole in the wall of the factory here? And she tries, but it doesn't work. And he tells her, obviously, there's a molecular field of some sort that protects the factory. So tells a couple of his people to go get this other device. Kelly Kane and Dennis Swan go up there, and they bring this floating thing that can float, several, four feet in the air, and they set it out, and it interacts with this molecular field, and it just hovers there. And then she fires again and is able to put a big circular hole in the wall. So they all go through it, and they're all walking around, and all of the workers inside this place suddenly attack them. And in the midst of the attack, Ms. Mystic says, no, something is wrong. They're above. That object beyond those men is vibrating on a mental level. I think it affects those men. She destroys it, and all the men, they're like, where the hell am I? What, my head? Oh, brother, this must have been a long, long weekend. So they were all being controlled by whatever that device is. Ms. Mystic lands back down. A couple of the members of the group are kind of suspicious, and they voice that suspicion. She then tells them her story. They called me a witch. I was sensitive as a child, and this is back during the Salem-y witch hunty times. What is that? Is that the 1700s? Sometime there in the east coast of the U.S.? 1700? Whenever that was. Actually, I have a friend who is in Salem right now. On vacation. So she tells, she tries to help and then hides and then tries to help and hide and finally is discovered, and they put her to the stake and they're burning her. But I don't know how to describe this to you quite, but I removed my essential body from my mineral body and I injected myself into another dimension. Once there, I was alive but trapped and helpless for 300 Earth years, hoping, praying for someone, something, or some force to release me. And in this story, she gets all teary, and Dr. Ross comforts her, puts a hand on her cheek, actually. And she continues talking, and he says, well, you can come and stay with us. It'll be okay. You can help us. And then wipes away a tear. And I mean, he's just so friendly to her and everything. And I'm like, is he being controlled maybe by her, or she's emitting, empathy waves and he is succumbing or something, but it's just really squishy, kind of weird to me, I thought. So they're moving on into the factory further, and a couple more of the members are talking. And finally, the one says, look, we'll just talk about this later. We got crap going on here that we need to focus on. They see another circle. And they go, a lighted circle, they go towards it and they encounter Foreman. He's a big muscular dude with a construction hat on, pants and boots. But he's floating on a couple steel I-beams, okay? And there's this metallic rod that at the bottom bifurcates into two legs that are holding the steel I-beams. And at the top of this rod, it bifurcates into two handles that the Foreman is holding. And at the tops of the handles are guns that he's shooting. So this thing is causing the I-beams to float. It's how he controls the flying. And there's two guns, weapons on it as well, that he's using to fire towards them. Takes out Ms. Mystic first. Dr. Ross tries to identify themselves. He holds up an ID and the dude says, oh, thanks. Pow! And shoots at him. So he dives to the side. And they're running and diving, and the Foreman is shooting at him. Ms. Mystic here tells one of them, and you can't really tell because they're off panel. It's just a panel of her. She says, distract him a little bit. So that's why they're running and diving all willy-nilly. And then suddenly she levitates herself, gets underneath the I-beams, and with a yeah, she swishes her sword and cuts the I-beams in half, causing the Foreman to fall. He loses his hat, right? And then looking inside the construction helmet, Dr. Ross says, the control for the whole of the factory is in the helmet. Fantastic. I have no idea how he could tell by looking at that. And then Ms. Mystic collapses. And that is the end of our story. We do have an ad here on the next page for Silver Star, which, again, looking at my chart here, looks like the third episode of next season. I'll be talking about that book. Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers ad, and then another full-page ad for Gru, which I believe I have already mentioned. But if not, it will be coming up in the second episode of next season. From the Tales of Zed Rescue Rhapsody is a short 5-pager here. It's scripted, penciled, and inked by Chris Miller, colored by Daryl Isaacs, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. So basically, this is a fairy in a fairyish, jungly kind of land. She is found by something even larger than human size, some kind of grotesquery creature, maybe a demon, maybe a lizard creature, an orc, a troll, something like that. And it grabs her. She's screaming, and off to the side here, a sleeping, older, long beard, long haired, is it Rumpelstiltskin that slept? Is that whoever it is that fell asleep and his hair grew real long because he couldn't cut it? That's kind of what the dude looks like. Maybe puts you in mind more of a Tom Bombadil, but just with long white hair. And he's holding a flute of some sort as he's sleeping. Well, her yelling, help, 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 wakes him up, and he rushes towards her, running across vines and hopping across rocks in a stream and just, you know, all these fanciful kind of things, all the time playing his little flute as he's running around. Then suddenly he stops because he sees this thing that has gotten hold of the fairy. And again, this thing is about twice or maybe three times his size. And I picture him as human size, this old dude. So he's playing his flute and playing his flute. And suddenly he gets the attention of this lizardy creature, this we'll call it a troll, who in his questioning, well, what the heck is this, releases the fairy and turns his attention on the old guy. Starts trying to slug him, starts trying to stomp on him. But the man playing the flute, it doesn't soothe the savage beast, but it causes the savage beast to dance. Dance, monkey! No. So the beast is trying to dance, and the old dude acknowledges the fairy, and the fairy kind of gets his attention. So he starts paying attention to the little fairy and stops playing. Well, when he stops playing, the troll is able to grab a hold of him, gives him this big hug for playing nicely for it, and then starts, you know, wanting to try to dance with him and do all this kind of stuff with him, and then realizes that the music has stopped and there's no reason for him to do this, the troll, and that this old man is the reason the music stopped. So then he gets kind of angry about that, whips the old man around a couple times, releases him, flinging him through the air away from them, the fairy chasing after the old man, flying with the flute to give the flute back to the old man because it's his, or to help control the troll or whatever. And then it says, continued. That's the end of it. Gorgeously rendered, gorgeously colored. This Chris Miller person, off the top of my head, I don't recognize. But this is just beautiful, beautiful artwork and a nice little, very different 5-page short story compared to most of the rest of what Pacific Comics has been putting out. Full page ad for Pacific Presents The Rocketeer, next issue that I'll be talking about here. On the back page is a full page ad for Twisted Tales, which the first issue of that I will be talking about next episode. As we are, next Pacific Comics episode, as we're sitting here. And then the back page is a full page ad for The Silver Star, which I've already said whenever that's coming up here. Consulting the chart, or maybe I haven't. Let's see. Yeah, there we go. The third episode of the next season will be The Silver Star.